So we started this podcast with a little bit of a different twist, but we'll go from there. But I was just introducing you fine fellows, Senior Yankee Gunner and Martin, Mr. Heisenberg Camp. It's a pleasure to have you guys on. It's not been so rosy in the Arsenal world, but we're going to start with at the ever so wonderful place of the Champions League last week. Just to preface it, I was in the middle of class. I had a stream of the first half on. Everything seems to be going rosy. The last thing I see is us scoring a third goal, and I leave and walk across campus to go have some lunch, sit down, and watch the rest of the match. And by the time I'm there, it's already 3-2, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? So tell me a little bit about how you guys felt about this, whatever you'd call the second half display we showed at the Emirates midweek against Anderlecht. I'm going to start with you, Martin.
Well, not great, Joaquin. The second half did not go the way we would have liked. To state the obvious, I think it was the worst collapse we've had since the 4-4 Newcastle game. In practical purposes, it probably doesn't matter because we probably weren't going to win the group anyway, and I still feel like we're pretty much 99% to go through in second place. So, you know, the result does not bother me nearly as much as just the performance does. I mean, that Anderlecht is, I mean, I don't want to disrespect this team, but, I mean, if you look at their European record over the past couple of years, it's legitimately horrible. I mean, this is not a team Arsenal should be giving up three unanswered goals to at home, and that's incredibly worrying. It's the worst kind of choke job to basically have a 3-0 lead against a team like that and then just cough it up. And again, I mean, that, you know, does the result really hurt us that much? Probably not. But the problem is you watch that and you think this is a team that has a lot of very fundamental problems that I'm very worried about. And I'm sure we'll talk about the league game over the weekend later. But, you know, I think that was a precursor to what happened this past weekend. And that's very worrying when you've got a team that can't keep a 3-0 lead at home against what I think is not a very good European team. So it was awful. They just fell apart. It looked like they totally lost any kind of focus or discipline or what they were supposed to be doing. And I don't have a good explanation for it, but it's something that needs to be fixed if Arsenal's going to have any kind of success going forward.
Elliot, what do you think was the reason for the downfall there? Like, what do you think happened in that second half?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is what happened in the second half wasn't much of a departure from what happened in the first half in that they created a lot of chances to begin with. And, you know, whenever a team sees that they can create chances and they can get into space and that they can get trouble your back four, I think it emboldens them and it gives them the confidence. And I think based on the chances they created earlier in the match, Anderlecht had the self-belief that if they kept going, we would give them chances because that's what we do. And because of the success they had against us, not in the final result, but in the game we played at their place. I think the problem for me is I still see a team that just doesn't play 90 minutes. It doesn't. It's not a team. Arsenal is not a team right now that is capable of stepping on the pitch from minute one and putting in a disciplined, committed, focused performance until the final whistle blows. We haven't done it all season. Even in our wins, our good wins, like Galatasaray, you know, we gift them a penalty, get a man sent off, and spend the last 35 minutes on the back foot. Against Villa, it was basically 10 minutes that decided the game. You know, I think in terms of not being switched on, that's a problem. And I think you can look at the manager for two things in the Anderlecht game. One, the obvious one that's been done to death is the substitutions. No one understood the Podolski substitution. They understood it in theory that it was, well, let's try to win 4-2 instead of draw 3-3. But it didn't make a lot of sense. The substitutions were reactive. They came late, and they were not very understandable to me. But I think you can go another direction with this, which is just that the manager is never heavy rotation. He didn't rotate in that game. He's still picking the same players every week to play every game. And I think it's only natural that players are going to have dips in form and in concentration. And if you think Anderlecht at home is a game you should win, and it is one we should win, we have great players in the squad. If you think Podolski can have joy against them, start him and give someone a rest. Start Rosicki and give someone a rest, because those players should have something to prove. They should be fresh. They should be out to prove a point. And then, God forbid, you get in trouble, you're bringing in arguably your best players late in the game. But I just think the failure to rotate, the failure to really have a feel for the system we're playing, the failure to stay focused and committed for 90 minutes, and just the general fact that we are very play right now, teams get chances. And anytime teams know that they're going to have space to run into and they're going to have chances, they're going to stay switched on because teams love scoring goals. And I'll tell you guys something. You know, it used to be, back in the day, the weaker teams didn't have players that had pace and trickery and scoring ability. But at the top level now, there's pace in every team. There's reasonable talent in every team. The game's just grown that way. And if you give any team the kind of space behind your fullbacks that we do, and you defend with two players, one of whom can't run at all, teams are going to love playing against you. And I just think right now every team that comes up against us has fun, for the most part, because they know we're going to kick it into space behind the fullbacks, and we're going to run, and we're going to put the shits up them. And that's what Anderlecht did. They created chances from the beginning. You could say that 3-3 was a collapse, but on balance, if you looked, you could argue that they had as many chances to score goals in that game as we did.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, they had plenty of chances. Did you guys feel like, Martin, do you think that, you know, a lot of people mentioned Arteta and his injury. Do you think that really made a difference? I mean, have we looked better with him, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I'm, hands up. Like, I guess I should come to confess, for I have sinned, because I generally think I've kind of been a Flamini cheerleader, at least relative to most Arsenal fans. And generally, I think I would have made the case that I think he's a better fit for this team and a better player than Arteta. But I think I was just wrong. I think I'm at least wrong now. Because I definitely think Arteta, for all his flaws, which are that I think he's a very limited player. Frankly, I'm not really sure we're using him in his best position. I think he may function better as kind of a playmaking midfielder for a club like Everton. I don't know that that's the job we want him to do. But, he's a smart player. He's a poised player. He's a mature player. I think he has those qualities that, frankly, I think Flamini doesn't. Flamini, obviously, he doesn't get red carded a lot, but he does often get a yellow card that forces him to change the way he plays. He gives away stupid fouls. And as we saw this past weekend, he gets caught out of position a lot. Trying to be too aggressive. And I think Arteta, especially with a 3-0 lead, I feel like Arteta is kind of the guy you want, because he's not gonna do anything that's incredibly stupid. He may not create a lot, he may not be the guy you want to sort of spring that counterattack going forward. But I frankly think if Arteta had not gotten hurt, I'd feel fairly confident in saying we would not have lost that game. And I think his injury cost us, pretty dearly there.
So, Elliot, there's been a lot of players, you're talking about guys that have been a bit out of form, that haven't looked particularly good. One that I think we've been debating a bit for the past few months is Santi Cazorla. He has certainly not been able to find the final ball. And without a doubt, I mean, you have to say he's having his poorest patch as an Arsenal player. The question is, is it just form, or is he just past it? Because you think of how many years he's been around. I mean, he was on the Villarreal team, 8 years ago that we faced. I mean, the guy's been around for quite a while.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just feel like I don't know that the current system is working for him really well. He's definitely out of form. I mean, the biggest area you're seeing, it's in front of goal, right? I mean, he got into some really good positions over the last few games. He's just, his finishing has been atrocious. And the whole midfield just doesn't function. I was going to say to Martin, when he was saying, the difference between Flamini and Arteta is just Arteta is so important because he's so much better than Flamini. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right now, midfield is kind of a joke. I mean, if you look at the midfield we had against, not to skip ahead to the Swansea game, but if you look at that midfield, it's Flamini, Ramsey, and Cazorla. So you have a terrible player who's passed it, a good player who's playing as poorly as anyone in the side in Ramsey, and then Cazorla, who's just not, you know, who's in sort of indifferent form. And when your midfield is that bereft of form and quality, you know, and tactical awareness, because Ramsey has, the problem with Ramsey is he seems to have given up the parts of his game that made him valuable when he wasn't in form, chasing, tackling, covering back in this search for goals and glory that aren't coming either. You know, my issue with Cazorla also, though, is arguably we have options in that position, and Wenger doesn't rotate. I mean, he doesn't, you know, why keep Campbell if you'll never use him? Why resign Rosicki if you'll never use him? Why keep Podolski if you'll never use him? I mean, ultimately, whatever you think the qualities of these kinds of players are, they're in the squad, and a fresh Podolski or a raring to prove himself Joel Campbell or a energetic and committed Rosicki may be better than a struggling for form, worn out, playing every three days Santi Cazorla. But there doesn't seem any indication that the manager's willing to try something different. There also doesn't seem to be any indication that he's willing to try to change the tactics. And I think the problem you have for guys like Santi Cazorla, he is, you know, you look at Alexis, right? And Alexis right now is the hero of the side because of his running and his effort and his harrying. But, like, you have to put players in positions to show their best qualities. Cazorla is a tricky little dribbler. He likes to cut in from the wing. He likes to play in people running in behind, you know, get on the end of moves. But he's having to do a lot of jobs right now that I don't think suit his talents. And he looks frustrated. You know, I don't like to bring everything back to the manager, but when you give very talented players, yeah, I do. Okay, I want to bring everything back to the matter. When you give very talented players a detailed game plan of where to be in every scenario, what the opposition's going to do, you put them in positions that bring out their best qualities. They go out on the pitch, and two things happen. I think one, they know what to expect, and because and they're prepared, they're able to put their best quality forward. I think what we're seeing is a lot of disorganization and confusion for players, and so they're just sort of freestyling. They're just trying to figure it out. And a guy like Alexis can do that, and I don't know that all these players can. You know, I think a guy like Aaron Ramsey is a classic example of someone who needs the structure, needs the role, needs to be told what to do, because when he starts playing Hollywood balls and freestyling, his game turns into a mess. It's like an untied shoe. So some of this is down to form, no question, but I think a lot of it to me looks like, and it, the whole season, we don't look like a team. We look like a series of individuals that aren't clear on what their roles are and how to do them. And the minute things start to go against us on the pitch, the players and nervous, because I genuinely don't think they've been prepared the right way.
The sides looked bereft of ideas on occasion, that's for sure. I mean, how much do you think the lack of defensive stability. I mean, I you know, because you look at this, and I mean, Arsene had the quote, right? He said, you know, we scored three goals in the Champions League, which no one else did, but then they also conceded three. But, like, when has this side been able to concede goals like that and have any sort of success? It's just, we all know why there aren't enough people there. It's because Arsene didn't sign another defender, and yet we're still stuck wondering what, like, why this team can't put it together, yet we're so prone to lapses of concentration at the back.
I'll just say this really quickly because I've said this on a previous Pintcast, I think, and then I'll turn it over to Martin. But I absolutely, you know, Arsene recently got tetchy and said, like, you know, we are an attacking team. That's our philosophy. We're going to stick to it. I think some of the best attacking teams have a flair and an ability to attack because they have a solid platform to build on. When you put a solid back four in place that plays conservatively with a shield in front of them, and the front, you know, the really skilled attacking players don't feel that they have to constantly be working to prevent calamity at the back, I think it gives them a lot of freedom and a license to do the things they're really good at. You look at Chelsea right now. Cesc Fabregas is never going to be an awesome defender. Eden Hazard's never going to be an awesome defender. Diego Costa, I mean, other than to the extent they defend from the front. But they have such a stable platform behind them that they can excel. There's no question in my mind that our failure to defend and our failure to have discipline at the back and the failure for the attacking players to have the faith in their back five, so to speak, or back six to them has led to a stifling of the attack. And, you know, Naveen, who does a tactics column for 7 a.m. kickoff, he always talks about how he wants to see us pressing more aggressively. The thing that's frustrating is we're a team that seems like it's between two tactics, sitting back, trying to counter, and then wanting to press deep in the opposition half. But we never commit all the way to one or the other. When we press, it's Welbeck and Alexis and everybody else just watching them. So, you know, again, it's back to the fact that either there's not a plan or there is a plan and the players aren't following it, but neither conclusion, to me, is encouraging. And I'm sorry, we're 12 games into the league season and we've beaten Palace, Villa, Sunderland, Burnley. That's it. I mean, you know, at some point you look at the players that are there, and even with a bad back four, and even with Matthew Flamini at defensive midfielder, Arsenal should be putting up better results than that. That wasn't quick, but that, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that. I think it's certainly a 10-man, you know, 11-man effort. I don't know that you can hang out the back four to dry. I'm not the biggest Chesney fan in the world, but I think he's been okay this year. Obviously the back four is basically down to the last man, you know, no reinforcements, and it's kind of been patchwork. But, you know, frankly, I have been fairly pleasantly surprised by how well Nacho Monreal has played at center back, because I thought he was going to be a disaster. I think he's been okay. But, you know, a lot of the problem is, you know, mental error in Swansea. I generally think Callum Chambers has acquitted himself very well, but obviously on that goal, it was a mental error. He just stopped chasing his man. He should have blocked that cross out. He didn't. That led to a goal. But a lot of it's just, I think the whole team, you know, all 11 men just kind of powered down in these situations. I don't understand why. And all of a sudden, the back four just finds themselves under incredible pressure. We don't have that shield. Elliot mentioned Chelsea. I mean, we don't have a Matic guy or even a Ramirez guy to sort of to just break stuff up when it's coming through the middle of midfield. We just don't have it. And it seems like when we get a lead and we get into the situation, all of a sudden we just switch off and we're so vulnerable. And it seems like teams can basically just attack us at will and start bombing things into the box. And I don't. It may be a weird disconnection in philosophy, like Elliot said, of the guys up front not knowing whether they're supposed to be sitting back or pressing and just not doing the same things that as the back four does. But it's so notable that whenever we're in a situation where we're trying to protect something, you know, we as a fan just you feel so vulnerable because you've seen it so many times. You've seen this team just getting up in these positions and you know it's coming. You know goals are coming. You know chances are coming from the other team because this, for whatever reason, this is just not a team capable of shutting down those chances and killing off matches. And it's just come back to haunt us time and time again this season. And as Elliot said, I mean, really, you look at the teams we beat. I mean, it's been a weird schizophrenic type season because you look at the teams we beat, given that it's the second week in November, and say, God, that's so unimpressive. And you look at our schedule going forward and see we have a lot of top half teams to play between now and New Year's, and that's really disheartening. We haven't really lost to anybody, but it's just those draws, you know, are just killing us. We can't beat anybody. Yeah,
I thought we would have been racking up points through this little sort of run that we're on, but
if you remember, we were supposed to be racking up points after the last international break, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was it. It started with Hull at home, and we know where that went.
Yeah, right. And it was supposed to end, and going into these fixtures, now we have United and Dortmund, I believe, are our next two fixtures. Mm-hmm. Hooray, because those will go swimmingly. But that talk is for another day. Let's move on to the Swansea match. So now, what do you think, Elliot, Do you think we were that bad the whole day, or did you think it was just a certain thing that undid us? I mean, I think I remember watching it live. I think you tweeted that Gibbs' foul was a nice foul. One. I was with you at the time because it seemed like it was far enough out to where it wasn't going to be that dangerous, but he put in one hell of a free kick. I mean, honestly, so there's an argument as to be, you know, he could have made that foul 10, 15 yards earlier.
He probably should have done it sooner. There's a good question of why, with a one-goal lead, you know, who was it running on the ball? Was it the Predator-looking guy?
Emnes? It might have been.
It was an Emnes. There's a question of why, you know, it's Gibbs and Per Mertesacker are the only two people back defending a one-goal lead away. You know,
That's a good question.
I don't think we were good the whole day. The first half was a slog. It was just hard to watch. It was incredibly dull. There was not much going on for either team. I thought we came out with a little bit of a spark in the second half, and the goal we scored was an exceptional goal. You know, I think Danny Welbeck probably should have scored his chance too. But other than that, there wasn't a lot happening. And, you know, the fact remains that when you get that one-goal lead, not to use any subs, not to rotate any players out from Anderlecht, not to cost it. You know, what happened in Anderlecht against Anderlecht should have cost someone a place in the side. You know, make an example of someone, bench someone, rotate someone. You know, I just don't see a message being sent to these players that they have to produce a performance for 90 minutes and stay focused and disciplined to be a starting player at Arsenal Football Club, because you know, Arsene Wenger basically acknowledged after the Anderlecht game that players switched off, but he went right back to those same players in a big away match in the league. Per Mertesacker after the Swansea game said, you know, we need to be more serious about our football. And everybody needs to take responsibility for defending, but if both fullbacks and Matthew Flamini are 30 yards away from their goal with a one-goal lead and 20 minutes to go, I can't believe they're doing that on their own. That must be what's being worked on in the training ground. That must be the way the team is being set up. Because there's only two possibilities. One, that's the plan, and they're executing it. Or two, that's not the plan. The players continually disobey the plan and do their own thing, and the manager's not disciplining any of them by taking their place away. You know, everybody wants to talk about how pathetic it is that we're down to a situation where Chambers has to play right back every single game and Nacho Monreal is playing center back every single game and Matthew Flamini is playing defensive midfielder. Yes, those things could have been solved in the summer. But when a team like Arsenal is a one-goal lead away and 20 minutes to go, you should be able to close the game out, even with that personnel. And it's not like, you know, the free kick was a byproduct of just bad luck. It was a byproduct of a player running at full speed against two defenders with nobody else back. So the thing that's frustrating is we're seeing this, you know, Martin said this, so I'm really reiterating what he said, but we're seeing the same thing over and over and over again. It was a couple seasons ago that it looked like we were going to miss out on top four finish, and what did we do? We went to a defensive setup, and we shut games down, killed games, played boring football, but got there in the end by being solid at the back and getting goals where we could. And I just think the way we're playing right now is either naive or incredibly arrogant. But let me ask you this, you guys. What's our best performance of the season? Is it
Community is Shield?
Yeah, that doesn't count.
Probably.
I mean,
hey, it's a trophy.
That was I think that was the season high, right? Going in open.
That absolutely was the season high. Yeah, yeah. I mean, because the problem is, if we were playing well, like let's say we were super dynamic in attack, but a car crash at the back, which we've seen seasons like that before, I think I could accept that more because I could say that's our identity and the personnel isn't there at the back. But we're not dynamic in attack, and we're still shipping goals. So it's just there's not a lot to feel very good about right now. I just think it's diminishing returns with, you know, Arsenal is getting less with more at this point.
Yeah, I agree with that. And if I can jump in, I agree with all that. And I think one of the things that bothered me the most about, you know, aside from just the general crappiness of losing a you know, blowing a 1-0 lead to Swansea, was the fact that, you know, Swansea are a team that have a very distinctive identity. Everybody knows this. You know, they're changed managers, but they're still very much the same team as they were under Laudrup, which is that they're kind of this poor man's Barcelona. Their whole thing is possession. Their whole thing is building up from the back. And their whole thing is sort of slowly moving the ball up the pitch. And you know, that's admirable. I like them as a team. I think, yeah, you know, the Premier League is better for having teams like that. But everybody knows who they are and what they do. And that's when you have a 1-0 lead, the one thing you do is just, you know, you just don't let them – you kind of sit back and play against that strategy. And what we do, we give up a set-piece goal and a counter-attacking goal, the two things they're not good at. You know, we set up exactly wrong and let them beat us in these ways that they really should not be beating us. It's sort of incredible that I don't know. I think Wenger got that so wrong, and I generally feel like I'm a defender of Wenger. I'm a big fan, and certainly I think I'm probably more positive generally about him than Elliot is. But you know, it's sort of unbelievable how I think he's very bad at tailoring his strategy to a specific game. And he's particularly terrible about, I think, changing the tactics as the game develops. And you know, I think Gary Neville or somebody pointed this out. But you know, you're up 1-0 against Swansea, and you get caught with 8 men ahead of the ball. You know, I mean, it's just we played that entirely wrong. It was we had a lead against a team that I think shouldn't have been able to break us down the way they did, and we got it all wrong. I mean, the substitutions were wrong. I mean, I'm never right about anything, so I'll take credit for as soon as that Podolski substitution was made, I said something on Twitter. I just didn't understand that at all when you had Theo Walcott on the bench, and that's sort
in
of
the Anderlecht game
for yeah. Theo Walcott, and it just I just feel like with you know I don't think we did not play well. I mean I agree with what Elliot said. I thought from about the 40th minute to the 70th minute, I actually think Arsenal played pretty well. We had a good spell at the end of that first half, and then the beginning of the second half, we were really good. But then it all came unraveled, and that, I don't know, just there was just no sense of making strategic adjustments to the situation. It was really frustrating.
Let me ask you a question, though, right? So here's the question. It was clear that all day long, Callum Chambers was getting roasted by Montero, all game. He couldn't live with him.
Completely obvious.
It was clear that was going to be a problem at some point. We had dodged bullets throughout the game, and you get that 1-goal lead. Where is the instruction or where's the tactical intelligence on the pitch by the players who are playing and the discipline and the fear of the manager and the instruction from the manager to say, now we have to protect our right flank so that Callum Chambers doesn't get isolated on Montero, who's been roasting him all game. Matthew Flamini is a terrible football player. He's bad at football. But I'll tell you when he's not going to be any good is when he's 18 yards away from Swansea's goal with a 1-goal lead when we turn the ball over. Alexis Sanchez loses the ball, and Matthew Flamini is 18 yards from Swansea's box. That doesn't help us. All they have to do then is kick it into space because there's no one behind him. Ramsey and Flamini are both ahead of the ball when Alexis loses it, and there's no one back there. But Callum Chambers, who can't live with the pace of Montero, Per Mertesacker, who can't live with the pace throwing under his feet, and Gibbs, who hustles back and gives away a foul. I mean, to me, this is where a manager earns his stripes in a game. We're 1-0 up. Callum Chambers has been getting roasted. Maybe you bring in Bellerin, and you play Bellerin at right back, and you play Chambers just in front of him. I mean, we've seen Wenger make subs like that in the past where he'd bring in Nacho to play left back and push Gibbs up in front of him to firm things up.
Right.
Or maybe, you know, he brings on, you know, a more midfield-oriented player like a Rosicki, right, and tells, you know, a Cazorla to drop back more into midfield and pack the midfield. The point is, we stayed with the same system, and all game long Chambers got roasted. No one did anything about it on the pitch or off the pitch. And it's frustrating because you'd like to believe there are enough leaders on the pitch who see that Chambers is getting roasted and can take some kind of responsibility for helping him. But ultimately, a manager has to fix that problem. When you have a player who's a liability on the pitch, you have to take some responsibility for fixing it. And it's not a coincidence that the winning goal came from Chambers getting beat and Nacho Monreal getting out-jumped. You know, when Gomis comes on, maybe you bring in Bellerin and you tuck someone in to help Bellerin, but you use his pace to stop Montero, and you move Chambers to center back, and maybe you move Nacho into midfield or something so that now you have a little more height. The point is, I'm not a physician. I don't know what the answer is. I know the answer wasn't to leave Callum Chambers on an island to continue to get roasted. And so,
It was a tough situation. He was in a very tough situation because Chamberlain's in front of him. Chamberlain's been our one most – I mean, he was more dangerous than Sanchez was during most of that match in terms of what he was creating down the flank. It was really tough. I don't know, like, do you – considering he looked like our most successful and dangerous outlet, do you make him stay back? I mean, you could say with the lead that you should, that maybe that is when he stays back. I mean, do you switch flanks and then it's Alexis there and then you put, you know, then you switch the matchups? I don't know. It's really easy to look at it in hindsight as to what the changes should have been. But regardless, the team looked like it needed a change and no changes were made at all. So regardless is that, like, he waited until we were losing.
I don't want to just sort of parrot things that other people have said, but he chose to bring on Yaya Sanogo, who's never scored a goal for Arsenal, instead of Lucas Podolski, you know, who at that point, the funny thing is, he uses Podolski when he's protecting a lead against Anderlecht, when Sanogo's running and work rate might have been more valuable. And then he uses Sanogo to try to get back in a game, who's never scored a goal when Podolski's goal scoring experience might have been more valuable. So,
And the week before, he used Podolski against Anderlecht, and it worked. So, like, you see him use the tactic correctly, and then he fucking doesn't do it, and then he goes with Sanogo. It is a bit mind-boggling. I mean, it looked like they just wanted him to cause havoc up there and get on the end of some long balls, which seems like that's the only tactic that could make any sort of sense to me in the situation. I mean, I guess that's your only justification. I mean, I think the goals speak differently, and that's a pretty easy decision to make, but... it's ridiculous. So what does Rzeczywski have to do? Martin, what do you think about Tomasz Rzeczywski and the fact that he hasn't played at all? I mean, does he look like absolute dog shit in training? I mean, what does he have to do to get a match? Because this is a guy who's done a lot for us, a guy who can set the tempo and be really can really help movement and do stuff in our midfield where we've been so
awful.
Yeah, awful, lacking dynamism, everything. Like, what do you think, Martin? What do you have to do?
Yeah, I mean, with the obvious caveat that none of us see what's going on in training, I mean, it's pretty baffling because I, candidly, I'm not a huge Rzeczywski fan, but I do think he's a pretty great guy when you're trying to kill off a match because he works really hard. He's got really good positional discipline. He's good at keeping the ball. And, you know, it would be a totally different story if we had somebody who was playing that number 10 role and who was playing really well. You know, you could say, well, like, obviously he's not going to displace, you know.
Yeah, Ozil,
Maradona.
If he's healthy. But we have players that you could say that about if you had a fit and informed Jack Wilshere even. But if you had Ozil playing to his potential, then you could be like, well, no wonder Rzeczywski doesn't play any minutes. But with him not there and Cazorla out of form, it fucking baffles me.
No, it does me too, and I think Cazorla's just, you know, been so out of form that I don't really understand why you wouldn't, especially, you know, as Elliot said earlier, if you think you have a high degree of confidence of beating a team like Anderlecht at home, which I think we should have, I don't really see why you wouldn't, you know, give Cazorla a break, send him a message, whatever, but bring Rzeczywski into the squad. Give him, you know, a good 70 minutes against a team like that. I don't understand why you wouldn't do that.
Yeah, we're left in a really weird situation.
Go ahead, Elliot.
I was just going to say, just really quickly, you know, I think for the most part, the manager, sometimes you have to show players that if they're not playing well or if they're not playing the way you want them to, then they don't get to play. And starting Aaron Ramsey, who's in bad form, but not just in poor form, not doing the basics, maybe you put Rzeczywski in and you sit Ramsey's ass on the bench in Wales, where he probably really wants to play, and it refocuses him. And it gives him that hunger to say, I'm going to show the manager that he can trust me and depend on me. I mean, you know, I believe the players love Arsene Wenger and love playing for him. But I believe part of the reason they love playing for him is because His instruction is basically go out and express yourself and play your football and let your game show through. And if they play poorly, they get to play the next week. I'm not in the dressing room, so I don't know what happens. But I think a manager, a boss, I mean, we all have bosses in some walk of our life. A good boss is someone you respect and like, but also have just that little pinch of fear of, the fear of what happens if you disappoint them or let them down. And I wonder if that's missing from Arsenal's boss, you know, and not just on the pitch, by the way, at every level, you know, at the board level and at the owner level.
The tough thing with this conversation is that, you know, it was certainly topical last year when he was in the last year of his contract and there was uncertainty in his future. And now it's like, you know, there's Arsene out, everyone wants to talk about this and that, but like, nothing's going to fucking happen. There's not going to be a change made. He's here for another 2.5 years, and there's no way, unless he decides himself that he's done a poor enough job to where he's going to be out, that it's going to be changed. And I don't see that happening. So it's tough to see, like, well, when we say that the changes that need to be made are things that are primarily the things that the manager could do to make changes, it's like, well, how do we teach this old dog to really change his habits? I just don't know. I don't know where the fuck we go with this, because we're stuck. We're stuck holding our dick in our hands because we can't do anything. He's here. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that he's not going to change what he's doing. I mean, I would be curious. I mean, I hope it doesn't happen. But if we don't win anything, which it looks like we're not going to win anything this season, and finish outside the top four, I mean, I'd be curious what actually happens. I mean, given the just sort of unequivocal support he's gotten from Kroenke and the board, I guess he would stay around, but I imagine there would be a lot of fan pressure. And frankly, I feel like the criticism of Wenger that he doesn't care about winning or doesn't want to win, this implication is a little bit unfair, because I do think you can see it on his face.
That's fucking
stupid. And he's just getting so, he's so upset
stupid
about things, but
I don't think anyone thinks he doesn't want to win.
Some people do.
Right.
I think the problem is, I think that Arsene convinced himself even that, given the disparity in resources, finishing top four is a remarkable accomplishment. And it is a remarkable accomplishment, but I think he's kind of allowed himself... Do I think he wants to win as anybody ever has? I do. But I think he believes that being fiscally responsible and not pushing the boat out too far in the transfer market and coming in finishing in the top four is a very creditable accomplishment. And while I think we all agree that it is, I don't know that he understands that. You know what the worst thing is in life? Stasis. If your life is going down the shitter, it sucks. But you know, you get consumed with it going down the shitter, and then eventually it turns around and starts to go back up, and you're happy because things are improving. Stasis is horrible, because people get very restless when things are in stasis. And I don't think that Arsene understands it. Like, he's produced remarkable consistency, but it's hard to celebrate finishing fourth every year. And this whole concept of the groundhog...
Because there's no real fucking trophy. It's not...
We won the FA Cup just last season, and that is a real trophy, and it felt wonderful, but like... Nobody anymore believes we're progressing towards a title. Going into this season, I thought we're trending in the right direction. And I think the reason that there's so many people upset this season is everybody believed the ship was turning. And going into this season, we were going to buy the players we need and mount that challenge again. And our time was coming back. And this season has just fallen apart. And now it looks like not only are we not turning around and coming back, we're sliding right back into the rut we've spent 10 years in.
I wonder, because, you know, we bought players, and I think they were talking, I was listening to the Arscast Extra this morning, they're talking about the players we bought seem to be quality players, right? I mean, I like just about everyone we've signed, and I think they're quality players, and yet we're not getting as much out of them. Like you said earlier, Elliot, he's getting less out of more. I'm not the kind of guy who likes to put that all on the manager so much. I know he's obviously the guy whose head is that has to, you know, roll for this in theory. But, like, we have all these players that played so much better in seasons past. You just aren't performing, and I don't know how much I blame. I want to blame them more than the manager, honestly. They're on the fucking pitch. They're making the mistakes. They're doing this. I mean, obviously the coaching matters quite a bit, but the players are the ones out there making these mistakes and all this with, you know, in successive matches and we're looking at this the team on paper, and they look too good for these types of mistakes. I just don't know, like, where does the buck stop? It's just so tough. So, Elliot, so we have, like you said, we were trending towards, this is a season that we thought was going to be, you know, at the very least, another title challenge, and we're going to make progress. You know, we signed another big-name player. We got Alexis. You're going to make progress. And now even, like, would finishing third this season feel like any sort of success to you, Elliot?
It might, only because right now it feels like we just need to stay up. I'll put it this way. The manager made a rod for his back when he started the season without adding a center back or improving the defensive midfield. No one has a problem with any of the signings he made. Everyone has a problem with the signings he didn't make. And the problem with Arsen is, unless he finds exactly what he's looking for, he doesn't seem willing to buy. We probably could have won a league by now if he had improved on Almunia in those 2007, 2008, 2009 years. We probably could have won a title last year or this year if he had bought a striker last year or if he had bought a center back this year and Cesc Fabregas, but he didn't. And I just think that for whatever the reason, this is a manager who prefers to develop talent than buy it. I realize we don't have the money to buy a team. I'm aware of the challenges. If I felt he was getting the here's my final point. The transfer market is something we can always debate to death, and we'll never know exactly what's going on behind closed doors. I was willing to accept the team we started the season with. If I felt he was getting the most out of the players he did have, then we could debate forever whether the transfer market let him down or whether he let himself down. I think we are getting less than we should be getting with the players we do have. I would take third place right now only because I don't know what's going to come of this season. I think the January transfer window's Koscielny may not play more than 5 or 6 more games the rest of this year. I think I said this on Twitter last night, and I'll end on Arsene Wenger is a great man who at one time revolutionized English football and brought us the best football years Arsenal has ever seen. And what he did helping us transition to the Emirates is amazing. I think he is a man who is in the autumn of his career and is no longer at the top of the game as a manager. Does that mean he's a fool or a moron or incompetent? Not at all. But I think at the very, very, very top levels of world football, you need a very, very, very top manager. And when you look at Ancelotti, Guardiola, Jose Mourinho, those are your best managers around Europe. When you look at what Simeone did last year with Atletico Madrid, and I just don't think Arsene Wenger is in that collection of managers anymore. Not because he's incompetent or terrible or stupid or none of those things. I just get to a point everybody does in their career where they start to slide down from their best. Our manager has. It's impacting the team. And until he's gone, I think we can still stay in the top four and occasionally play well, but I don't think we'll ever be really challenging again.
So no more wins, no more titles under Wenger is what you're saying. That's your prediction for the next couple of
years. No more titles under Wenger. I mean, you know, I think he would need to bring someone in who would help him on the tactical side, and I think he would need a big change of heart the way he builds the team. You can't have blind spots. You can't clearly try to make do with missing a striker or missing a goalkeeper or missing a center back. I think the make-do solutions have let him down time and time again. I feel for him because I love the man. I mean, the thing I think people forget, and Martin and Joaquin, you guys will agree with me this, almost everyone who's an Arsenal supporter in America found Arsenal while Arsene Wenger was manager. It was hard to watch European football in the 90s. It was hard to find it on TV. It was hard to come in contact with it. I came in contact with it working in London in 1998-99. I've only ever known Arsene Wenger. I have immense respect for him. I've never known an Arsenal with anyone else. But I think there comes a time when you have to see. It's like, I think Tim Clark said it. It's that day you wake up and you realize Dad doesn't know everything. Dad's not a superhero. He's just a man trying to figure it out like the rest of us. Arsene Wenger's a great, great man, but he's not an infallible man, and maybe his best is behind him.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think we'll leave it there with that. Okay. With you, Elliot. Thank you so much, Elliot, for joining us. You can follow him on Twitter at Yankee Gunner. Always a pleasure. We're going to continue with Martin. We're going to talk a little bit about the MLS. We've seen quite some interesting playoffs. You actually were watching. You got to see some of the Eastern Conference, right? So tell us a little bit about that, Martin, and what your thoughts on how the Eastern Conference is playing out.
Yeah, well, I'm a DC United season ticket holder. Live here in DC, and we had a great season. Obviously, biggest turnaround in MLS history. It was a really great team. So we were sad to see that end. Just really thought we had what it took to get rid of Red Bulls, but I think it has ended up with a pretty marquee matchup in the Eastern Conference Finals with the Red Bulls and New England Revolution. Obviously Arsenal fans have kind of a vested interest in seeing Thierry Henry go just a little bit longer. He hasn't officially announced retirement yet, but the rumors are swirling. I think I, like many Arsenal fans, would like to see him end his career carrying a trophy off the pitch. And they're a very good team, between him and Bradley Wright Phillips. They've got Tim Cahill and Leon Dalla too. Got quite a bit of talent up there. But I think New England is the best team in the Eastern Conference right now. They really have been ever since Jermaine Jones came over. I only saw the second leg of their matchup with Columbus, but yeah. I mean they're an incredibly impressive team. If people haven't seen them play, they're really worth checking out. They don't have a lot of marquee names. I feel like of the four teams left, they're definitely kind of have the least sex appeal or whatever, or people sort of identify with them. But Leighton Wynn's been the best player in the MLS this season. I think that guy's so fantastic and so fun to watch. Fagundes is great. And they really just – they can hurt you so many ways. I mean, they really just – when they start to attack, they just swarm. And they have five or six guys. They've got Bunbury and Charlie Davis used to play for the national team. And Bunbury used to play for the national team. They really go at you. They can hurt you so many different ways. Frankly, I would really recommend people that aren't sort of casual MLS fans or aren't big MLS fans. I think that Eastern Conference Finals could be a really fun matchup because both those teams have a lot of attacking talent and neither of them are great defensively. So I really think we could end up with some 3-2 or 3-3 games. In that matchup, Red Bulls have Henry and Wright Phillips, and can hurt you, but I think the Revolution really, they're really fun to watch. They can score a lot of goals. They really pour it on you, and I think they've been a lot more solid defensively since Jermaine Jones has come over. I think they're the favorite there, but you can never count out a team with Thierry Henry and Bradley Wright Phillips. So I think it could be fun. And obviously, I'll be interested to see because I think, I don't know, to me it feels like the MLS has had a great season, and I think, in terms ratings-wise or buzz-wise, I think they're headed for the best final they've ever had, particularly if, Los Angeles makes it to the final. I don't really follow the Western Conference as much, but, between all the, obviously they've got a lot of marquee players, and it would be Landon Donovan's last game in the championship, and LA's a big market, so... I don't know. It feels like this has been a big season for MLS, a good season. They got the new TV contract. They've had a great playoff so far. The Eastern Conference is good. I still probably think the two best teams in MLS are Seattle and LA, but I think either of those teams, particularly New England, could really surprise some people in the finals. So I guess my East Coast representing, I hope whoever makes it out does it. But it should be a good matchup.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be very exciting. I mean, these teams have really, I've been impressed with some of the level of football I saw during the regular season, but the playoffs have really impressed. They've been really good. I mean, to be fair, that's when I've really paid more attention as soon as we got to the playoffs. But the quality's really jumped up. But the thing is, so people criticize the MLS because, it doesn't matter anything to the playoffs. Well, same with the fucking NBA or the NHL, It doesn't really matter. They're putting out a pretty good product for – basically the entire season, but when it comes down to the intensity, you really get it in these playoff matches, and it's been good. I mean, you know, I was privy to watch. I mean, I watched a blowout the other night with the Galaxy doing quite well against RSL, and that was, you know, to be fair, I think that was the first time that I could ever remember seeing, like, watching. You know, I just watched Arsenal early in the day, and then I'm watching the Galaxy put on like the best performance I've seen them play in maybe ever. I don't know. Possibly ever. With these goals and these well-worked balls and the movement, I'm like, what, since when do I actually watch Galaxy and think like, I wish Arsenal played like this? Like, yeah. I don't think I've ever said that. And I was thinking those exact thoughts yesterday. I was like, what the hell? I mean, the difference in the pressing of the other teams and the level of play is a slightly bit different, but it was really impressive. I'm really excited to see what the Revs can do. I've hardly seen them play at all, honestly. I've seen a few moments once Jermaine Jones was signed. But excited to see what they can do. You know, we have this great storyline, you know, and obviously the league would love it if it were a New York LA final, even a New York Seattle final. But New York LA is the sexiest matchup. You got all the storylines. You get Thierry Henry with, you know, his swan song versus Landon Donovan, you know, the greatest US player against one of the greatest in the world, you know, right, of the past decades. You couldn't ask for any more. You know, one of them is going to go out champion. That's, you know, I'm going to put my money on that actually happening. Just because I do really want to see it. I want to see Thierry do well. As much as the Revs are great, I really don't give two shits about Jermaine Jones.
But, nobody does. Yeah.
No, I mean, honestly, as well as he played for us in the World Cup, I've never wanted him anywhere near our national team. But that's another story. So it makes for some interesting viewing. It's really interesting to see this Galaxy team make RSL looks so pedestrian, because RSL's been one of the best teams in the league for years, and they've, you know, this season a lot of people thought they were one of the strongest teams in the league, and so to put that forth, that kind of display, I mean, I think it really bodes well for them going into the Seattle matchup. Seattle, you know, is a good team. You know, they've been, like you said, one of the best teams in MLS, won the season series with them, but you know, Seattle beat LA not that long ago, just a little while back. You know, that was surprising, and that was for, you know, who got the top seed in the West. So more power. You know, they earned that fair and square, and they're a solid team. So it's gonna be very interesting. I'm looking forward to the matchup. I'm looking forward to the Eastern Conference Finals. Who do you think's gonna make it out of the West?
I think LA's gonna make it, which I know sounds stupid given that Seattle just played them twice and kind of housed them, but I think LA is the best team in MLS. I have this feeling in my stomach that they're going to pull that out, but we'll see. I mean, I think those are the two best teams in MLS. Whoever makes it out of that will be the favorite in the final, but I'll tip Galaxy.
The Galaxy it is then. Yeah, I hope that your gut is telling me the right kind of information, because that's what I would love to see. We'll see if any of you guys are going to make it down to the StubHub Center for the next match. Let me know. We'll see if we get down there. I might try to get down there for that. We'll look forward to an interesting final, the end of these playoffs. I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Martin, for joining me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Been a pleasure as always. You can follow him on Twitter at HeisenbergCamp. Thank you so much. We'll be back. I don't know if I'll be doing one next week during the international break. Maybe I'll do something to preview the Manchester United match. I might actually bring on a United fan. Blech.
Yeah.
I know. Somehow I know some of these. I admitted the other day to having Manchester United fans for friends.
Yeah.
I never should have said that. But we'll leave it there. Thank you so much. We'll do this again. And, catch you later.
Have a good night. Thanks.
We saw the western coast, I saw the hospital, and there's the shoreline like a wound. Because the lover's tryst, we're neither clear nor